It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome, welcome, guys. Hey, I'm excited. I'm super excited because we've been giving away literally hundreds of dollars worth of gift certificates from Chili's, all for going to youtube.com/Bert J. Martinez. And, man, we got not only Chili's certificates to give away, we got some other stuff, tons of swag. So Bert Martinez, youtube.com, Bert J. Martinez is the place to go. Sign up. It's free. The videos are awesome. And you'll get free stuff. Yeah. You'll get entertained. You'll learn some stuff about business, about life, about money, mindset, and, you know, get to know all sorts of interesting people. Tom Hopkins did an interview with him not too long ago. There's my most recent interview is with Mike O'Hearn, four-time Mr. Universe. And he's also a Guinness Book World Record holder, does a lot of interesting stuff, definitely worth it, and doing some neat stuff with some other celebrities. So glad that you go there and subscribe to Bert J. I mean, to YouTube.com, Bert J. Martinez. It is totally, totally worthwhile. So, you know, check this out. You know, a lot of times you will see somebody in the media, specifically, you know, maybe they're under crisis, and you'll hear them say something like, no comment. And today's guest, Paul Blanchard, says this is like wrong, the worst thing you could do. You should never say that. Paul Blanchard is a global PR consigliere whose firm expertly handles crisis management for top-shelf clients. Blanchard knows crisis inside and out. He was in UK government before the shifting to high-level consulting and has felt that crisis-driven cold sweat himself. In his new book, Fast PR, Give Yourself a Media Boost, he enlisted a global team of media mavens to show their wisdom and combine their riveting nuggets with his own time-tested tips. The result is a Bible of saving face. If you want to emerge from a crisis intact, this is what you need to do and say. Paul Blanchard, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you ever so much for having me on. It's very much appreciated. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm excited to have you on here and talk about this. And so I got to jump right in and ask you about this claim that no comment is like the wrong thing to do. Talk about this.
Yeah, it absolutely is the worst possible thing you can do because it makes you look defensive. It makes it look like you've got something to hide. I think the only time that you can decline to comment on something is if you explain why you can't comment. There are often reasons why you can't discuss things with the media. There might be a pending court case. There might be matters of confidentiality, etc. And the audience, you know, of listeners or viewers or readers, whatever it is, will understand that, but you've got to explain it. So if you just say, no comment, people then immediately take an adverse inference. They think the worst. And it's also a little bit passive-aggressive. So, you know, most of the time, if you can't speak, you just need to explain why, because then the audience will say, well, that's fair enough. But on the other hand, if where possible, you should always try and, you know, account for your actions, explain the situation, because even negative media attention, even attention that's, you know, that you haven't particularly sought out that's unwelcome, I tell my clients to see that as an opportunity. You know, I'm a PR guy. I spend half my day trying to get the media interested in what my clients are doing. So if they ring me, even if it might be at first blush kind of unwanted, my view is, hey, at least they're ringing me. I can now hopefully turn them around and get some coverage for my client. And I think the most important thing here is if you don't comment, then you're going to have the media effectively use that airtime or that print space, all the article space to actually then speculate And that's terrible. So, for example, you know, by not commenting, it's not as if you're going to stop the media from running that story. But what they might do if you don't comment is to say, well, you know, our client, you know, Mr. X refused to speak about this yesterday, and he or she has five or six options, and here they all are. And the thing is that the reality is that some of them might be horrible options that you don't really want airing and you were never going to consider. Whereas what you do if you comment is you kill off that speculation, because then the article can say, we spoke to Mr. X last night and he explained that he couldn't comment in detail because it's a pending court case, but he did deny the allegation or said he'll look into the matter or whatever it is that you do. That then kills speculation. So it's not only about stopping the harm of saying no comment, but you're also missing an opportunity to get on the front foot with this, because any inbound inquiry from a journalist, you know, is going to result in coverage. So you can either cooperate with it and get have an opportunity to put your side of the story forward, can refuse to cooperate, and then all hell breaks loose.
Yes, yes. And I think that something that you said there that people really need to understand is that you can, in some cases, be able to use this to your advantage. And, you know, to me, a great example is when somebody gets out in front of it and says, you know what, we messed up and this is what we're doing to fix it. That to me is a good use of that, right? Hey, you know what, we're having the situation, we're doing the best to fix it. If somebody has a question, they can go to, you know, our website / you know, fixingthemistake.com, or call us at 800 whatever whatever, and you could turn it into, I think, into a positive scenario, or at least a more positive scenario where you have some control over it. Because what you said is so true. If you don't have a comment, then people, especially the media, love nothing more than to speculate, and they'll bring in the experts to speculate for you, and it goes on like that, and you know, for almost you know, ad nauseum, right?
I often tell my clients, they're chief executives of very large businesses, and they have thousands of staff around the world. And by the time a problem comes to their desk, it's often too late to fix, in terms of, you know, it's just you're into damage limitation mode. And what I say to them is exactly what you've just said there. Is, first of all, you should cooperate. But I tell my chief executive clients that this is exactly the same scenario. You're the CEO of a global business. Than if you were, say, the shift manager at a checkout in a supermarket or a Walmart or a Subway. Let's say that one of your staff in a local restaurant messes up and a customer's really angry and you're the manager. You come over to speak to the customer. First of all, he's angry. You weren't there. The manager was not there at the time. So all you can do is say to them, obviously this is the first time that I've become aware of it. I'm genuinely concerned. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. And I'm going to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And I'm so sorry for your trouble. Now, if you're in an upset situation, the manager comes and you can see that he or she genuinely cares, he's going to get to the bottom of it because we know the manager wasn't there, he's going to make sure it doesn't happen again and expresses genuine apology, you actually then think, well, do you know, he or she's actually done the best he can under the circumstances. And I was quite annoyed now, but, you know, fair enough, he or she's trying her best to sort it out. Now, that kind of customer service experience is exactly the same way that a business owner needs to deal with the media. Because you weren't there. Usually the chief executive or the leader of an organization was not there when that thing happened or didn't happen. So you have to be honest with them and say to them, yeah, I wasn't there, but I'm going to take this very seriously. I'm very sorry that it's happened, and I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen again. And as long as though you believe that as well and you mean that promise, authenticity is hugely important in all of this. But if you mean that, then the viewers, the listeners, the readers of the journal or the magazine or the radio program that you're on will hear that with their own ears and think, well, fair enough, they've messed up, but they're going to try and put it right. I genuinely believe this guy, that he's horrified at what's happened. He's going to put it right, and he's going to get to the bottom of it. Other than that, you know, we're not Superman. We don't have ESP. No one can do any more than that. So the effectiveness of it turns on the genuineness. Do you mean it or not? If you're just saying it and reading off, you know, pattern by rote, just getting a kind of customer service manual and saying, oh, where's, it's a bit like when you're on hold, isn't it? And the automated call attendant says, your call is very important to us. And you think, well, it isn't that important to us, otherwise I wouldn't be on hold. But, you know, no one likes that kind of automated apology. But if an apology is real, most of the time, the media and your customers will forgive you. And as you said, you can turn it into an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. And I think that also, Paul, that we as humans are bugged instantly when somebody refuses to take responsibility or refuses to give us an explanation as to why, as you said, they can't give us a comment. So I love the fact that if they can't give a comment, then give us a reason why. Listen, right now I've been advised by my attorney not to have a comment. You know, so under the, you know, so I'm going to stay with no comment. And at least, you know, you're giving them a reason. Or right now we haven't finished our internal investigation, so we have no comment at this time. You're letting people know as to why, and at least it pacifies us a little bit, as opposed to somebody who says no comment, no comment, no comment, and he comes off as a jerk.
And also the language you use is incredibly important. There is a standard playbook for this. I was actually in an airport a few months ago when that gentleman was assaulted on a United Airlines. And I remember CNN had a split screen where he showed the gentleman's bloody face. You know, he'd clearly been suffered injuries as a result of being removed from the plane. And on the other half of the screen, it was the tweet from United Airlines that said this passenger has been reaccommodated. And I almost spat out my coffee because I thought the actual backlash hadn't happened at that point, but I knew it was inevitable because I thought these guys have already messed it up. And even at that moment, I thought if the CEO of United Airlines had just said, I was as horrified as you were seeing those images. I'm going to get to the bottom of this, and I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen again. I feel desperately sorry for that man. We've clearly screwed up here, and we're going to fix it. That would have actually killed most of the anger there and then, right at the outset. And part of it is, yes, of course, the CEO wasn't on the plane and so on, but if he would have taken immediate responsibility for it, expressed empathy, and said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this, not happen again, most of the anger was a result of not only it happening, but also the clear implication of United Airlines, that they were blaming everyone but themselves, you know, that they just didn't handle it correctly. And I remember even seeing that tweet thinking, oh boy, these guys haven't even read PR 101. You know, I could have written that tweet better. And you know, the next day, although their share price recovered, of course, at one point the next day, $1 billion had been written off the value of stock of United Airlines, and a lot of it was due to the person who wrote that tweet. I mean, as you said, the power of PR can either make things massively better or massively worse. There was an accident here at Alton Towers here in the United Kingdom. Now, they're like the equivalent of Six Flags. They're like a theme park. There's roller coasters and so on. And there was a terrible accident about a year ago where a young girl who was riding it, there was obviously a technical problem, and the roller coaster crashed into one of the other cars, and she unfortunately lost the use of her legs. They had to amputate them. But that evening, the CEO of Alton Towers, the actual big boss, went on the television news, and all of the programs gave him hell. And he just kept saying, I am appalled. I mean, you could see he was genuinely, there were tears in his eyes. He said, you know, I run a place of joy. I'm trying to make money by bringing joy to people's lives. Do you think I want to hear that someone's actually lost the use of their legs on our ride? I mean, I'm appalled for everyone concerned, but most specifically for that poor girl. And because everyone watching it felt he meant it, that even though, of course, you know, the accident happened and they've tried their best to put it right, the damage that he mitigated the damage to their brand because people believed him. And why did they believe him? Because it was real. It was authentic. He wasn't just reading from a script saying, I am terribly sorry that this poor lady lost the use of her legs. An investigation is ongoing and our lawyers will settle with hers in due course. None of that. It was real. And most people, right, if they can sense that genuineness, that authenticity, they'll forgive, even in the moment.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the key word there is that sincerity, that authenticity, Because again, we as a society know when somebody just doesn't care, when, like you said, they're reading the script. We I want to extend our deepest sympathies to the, you know, young lady and to her family and blah blah blah, and as opposed to somebody who is remorseful, who is sincerely cares. Yes, we can see that. We can spot it a mile away. Let's talk about this. Keep calm and carry on. Keep calm and carry on. Why is this a critical business tactic?
Oh, hugely important, of course, because I've been in business over 20 years, and when I look at the mistakes that I've made over 20 years, which, as you can imagine, I've got a lot of things right, and I've certainly made a few painful errors along the way, but most of the errors that I've made are because I've felt hurried, or because I've been on the back foot, or I've reacted to someone. You know, the old adage my grandmother taught me when I was a child, if you're going to be rude to someone or you're angry with them, count to 20 first. Or go for a run, or remove yourself from the situation. You can always go back and challenge them the next day, but don't do it from a place of anger. And it's the same with business. Don't do it from a place of feeling hurried. And I think the importance of thinking calmly is very, very important. I mean, I've been progressively getting up earlier and earlier. The older I've gotten, the longer I've been in business. I mean, I get up at 4 a.m. now. And one of the reasons I do that is because between 4 a.m. and 6:30 a.m., that's my time. I can read, I can reflect, I can meditate, I can exercise. And more ideas come to me in those moments that I've monetized, that have had real business effects positively on my career. Because let's be honest, anything after 6:30 in the morning or when the business day starts, we're all screwed. We're all on the back foot reacting to things, this email, that client, this staff problem. You know, honestly, when I walk into my office at 9 o'clock every morning, the entire day is sometimes can go by, and then I can be driving home in the evening and think, wow, that was 9 hours of intense activity, but what have I even done? I can't remember even a single thing that I've done. And so I think the importance of keeping calm and carrying on is incredibly important.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've had the pleasure interviewing some of the biggest names in the world, and a lot of them attribute their success and their preparedness to getting up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning.
It's crucial to me. And the other thing was, it's slightly off topic, but I even gave up drink a few years ago because, even a few glasses of wine the night before stops your ability to get up at 4 o'clock effectively. And if you do, you're a bit groggy. And I value that time so much. That I actually don't want to, like, I don't eat a heavy meal late in the evening or any sweets or sugar because I actually think I'm borrowing that poise, that calmness, that insight, that chance to reflect. I'm borrowing or kind of taking from my effectiveness, my ability to be as calm and as focused as I need to be the next day, because you don't want to wake up and feel terrible because you're not in the right mindset. And so much now, more than ever, success in business just relies on having a different mindset and having a better culture. I mean, I run a PR agency in the United Kingdom called Right Angles. We're 25 people, we're in Covent Garden, we're right in the centre of London. And don't get me wrong, I've got some great people, etc. The problem is, though, is if I was a potential customer, there are hundreds of PR agencies in central London with 25 staff. I mean, what is it? We're all human beings sitting behind desks sending emails. What is it that we do differently to them? And it's an extremely difficult question to answer, of course, because ultimately what differentiates organizations is culture. It is what, you know, how, whether people are prepared to go the extra mile or not. And that, for me, is a manifestation of a decent and a positive culture rather than, hiring the right people. And again, whenever I've hired the wrong people over 20 years, it's usually because I've had a vacancy to fill and I felt I'm on the back foot and in a bit of a hurry. So when you say keep calm and carry on, you know, for me, that is very important, because if I hire the wrong person because I'm in a hurry, yes, it might solve the problem, or I might feel I've solved the problem for a week or two, but ultimately you've actually made it worse, because 2 weeks from now, when you have to fire that person that was the wrong hire, not only have you now got to start the vacancy again, but you've lost 2 weeks. So, you know, I think for me, that genuine, I know the word strategic is overused, and it's like a lot of really good business words, like proactive, they've almost become cliche because they're overused. But the truth is that proactivity and culture and strategy are the only differentiators in a service industry. And you have to find a way to get a genuine difference between you and your competitors. And that requires deep, deep thought, deep reflection, deep analysis. How can you possibly do that when you're midway through answering 120 emails? You can't.
Right, right. You know, and I want to visit a little bit about what you said. Hey, I gave up, you know, drinking. I gave up food, you know, certain foods past a certain time and stuff like that. And this to me shows, you know, real commitment, right? That this is obviously getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, as you said, is so valuable to you that you're willing to give up all these other things. And I'm sure that when people hear that, they're going, wow, that's just radical thinking. Interestingly, for me, I started, so I can not only get up early, I do want to get up early, but I also want to get a good night's sleep. You know, I've made getting up early and getting a good night's sleep important, and the only way to do that is to start shutting things off at 8:30. So I'm in bed by 9, and so I do what I can to be asleep by 9:30. And
great.
In order to do that, I've given up some other things, but as you said, the value that I get is worth it, right? And that's, you know, one of the things I just want to kind of spend a couple more seconds talking about, because everything in life comes down to the value you get. The reason you have certain friends and you is because they give you a certain amount of value. The reason your clients hire you, they give you a certain amount of – you give them a certain amount of value. And this thing is very important. And so if you want, you know – to use my example, if you want a good night's sleep more than you want other things, then you'll change in order to get that good night's sleep. If you value that quiet time between, let's say, 4 a.m. and, you know, 8 a.m., then like you're going to give up certain things so you can have that. And this value thing is so important because it really is all – in everything that we do, we just sometimes we don't pay attention that that's why we prioritize one over the other. And then, the other thing that you talked about, this cliche, what I have found is that sometimes a cliche is a cliche because people seldom act on it because it's too simple, right? I mean, yeah. Getting up early is too simple. It's a cliche. I'm not going to do it. You know, whatever. Watching what I eat, that's too simple. It's a cliche. You know,
it's hard.
It's hard. Yes, it can be. I think it can be. And I think, again, it comes back to why you're going to do it. Why are you going to give up, you know, this activity or that kind of food? And I think it comes back down to, you know, if you understand why you're doing it, the value that you get out of it, then you say, yeah, no problem. I'll give up sweets so I can wake up with more energy and vitality so I can get more stuff done by 9 o'clock than most people do all day long.
It's interesting as well because in terms of like the power of focus and focusing on that one thing, because ultimately if you are committed to that calmness, that early rising, then it has to come at a cost of something else, giving up, you know, like you said, yeah. Late nights. I mean, the early, I'm 42 now, but the early 20s version of me would have been horrified at the thought of going to bed early and getting up that early. Because, you know, I would have thought, I want to go to the bars and I want to have fun. And then I also want to get up early as well. Of course, the reality is I would go to the bar in the evening and then not get up early the next day. I would be late for work. And I don't, you know, I've been this disciplined now for about sort of 10 or 15 years. But, I went through a period of being very, very undisciplined, and I've learned the power of it, the opportunity cost of missed opportunities, all of those kind of things. I mean, I've actually got a couple of clients that are from Russia, and one of them, Igor, is a lovely man, and he's got a really strong turn in kind of pithy Russian aphorisms. You know, whenever I've spoken to him about problems in business, because I like that with my friends, I build up a friendship with them. But Igor's very good in terms of he'll always invoke a kind of ancient Russian proverb that lasts like 10 seconds, like one line that nails it in a really profound way. And I was talking to him about the power of focus about 6 months ago, and he turned around and said, well, in Russia, we have an old proverb if you try to catch two rabbits at the same time, you won't catch either. And I just thought that is, like you just said, it was so simple but so profound. It's so obvious
right.
when you think about it. And that's why you could almost... I laughed when he said it because I thought, but it was a laugh of recognition. And do you know what? That's such an incredibly profound truth expressed so clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that I've learned over time is that all truths are simple. Again, like you said, they may not be easy, but they are simple.
Absolutely. But as we've said, they're hard. That's the problem. I mean, you know, this kind of discipline, it is hard. But I think ultimately, there are no shortcuts to true success. They require sacrifice and hard work. And I mean, I work with some global CEOs that have like 50,000 staff in 30 countries that by every measurable standard, they're incredibly successful. You would look at their life from afar and think, wow, they must have it easy. Actually, these people have got there because they're so disciplined and hardworking and tenacious and focused. And they're still like that now because, you know,
right.
this is the problem. Once you've got to the top of the ladder, you then have to work hard to stay there. And people, you know, whenever I've looked at someone's life before I've met them, I thought, wow, these guys are great. I wonder, you know, they seem to have been lucky. It's never been luck. It's always been hard work.
Yeah. There's that saying. I don't think it's a Russian proverb, but the saying is, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yes.
So, all right, let's talk about this. You were talking a little bit ago about proactive. And one of the things that you talk about in your book, and I want to shout out the book one more time here. Fast PR, Give Yourself a Media Boost. Again, the author is Paul Blanchard. So in the book, Fast PR, Give Yourself a Media Boost, you talk about preparing for crisis in advance. What are you talking about? Why?
Crises are going to happen to businesses. You might as well either have things ready or not. Because the problem you've got is often in crisis, the crisis has arisen, and there's a business problem to fix as well. So say, you know, if you're an airline and a plane has a massive problem and it can't take off, you've actually got the reputational crisis, but you've also got the problem with the plane itself, the technical problem. You've got to coordinate it being fixed and getting the staff off and blah, blah, blah. So often the management of the reputational fallout of a crisis is the last thing that's on people's mind. If you've got 10 staff stranded in the Antarctic with no hope of being rescued quickly, everyone rightly puts all of their efforts into the rescue attempts. You know, so there's very few people. Often during a crisis, the actual reputational fallout is forgotten about, and it's a missed opportunity because that's when the media are at their most strongly interested. But also, for example, you know, sometimes I'll work for a global client and then maybe one of their directors might get into some legal problems or whatever. But, you know, say, four people around the world that can actually make a decision whether to fire this guy or suspend him or laugh it off or say they're going to invest, whatever it is, often just getting those four people together to actually make a decision is a problem. So with some of our big corporate clients, with their CEOs and their global leadership team, I actually have a kind of laminated card in their wallet that says, if there's a crisis, here's the conference call number, here's the PIN, and then we'll actually text all four of them and say, 20 minutes from now, there's going to be a conference call to discuss this issue. You need to be on it. Because I can't tell the media and therefore the world what the company's going to do about something until they've decided what to do about it. And that sounds such an obvious thing to say, but that's one of our big problems in PR, is that sometimes the media will come to us with something they've discovered, and often they'll have found out before the company. So, you know, I've rung executives before and said, oh, this is happening. They've gone, what? That's outrageous. I'm like, oh, you didn't even know. And then they'll say, well, three other people need to be involved in this decision about what we're going to do about it. And we literally can't get the other three on the phone because one's on holiday, the other one's at a funeral, and the other one's, you know, on a sabbatical or something. And you're thinking, right, okay, so you need to decide how as a company you're going to handle these kind of fallouts. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of preventing, you know, planning for a crisis in advance in terms of, clearly the fact it's a crisis means that it was unforeseeable. But what is foreseeable is that you will have a crisis from time to time, and therefore you need to plan about, you know, to identify who the decision makers are, what you're going to do about it, who's the nominated spokesperson to the media. Again, one of the tactics that journalists do is if you're a company with 100,000 staff around the world and only four people in the world can actually discuss that with the media, you need to tell all the staff in advance that they can't communicate with the media as well, because it's an old journalist trick to ring a middle-ranking executive up that has no power over the situation, but then is tricked into saying something like, well, you know, we might do something like that, we might not. And then in the absence of executive input, that's what the media will run with, because they will say, speaking yesterday, a middle-ranking manager at this company said, oh, yeah, there's no problem, and yet here's the pictures of, you know, the accident, blah, blah, blah. So you also need to agree who can and who can't speak to the media in these opportunities, so that if a lower-ranking board member is approached by the media to say, well, you know, we can't get over the upper-ranking board members, what's your view on this big crisis? He or she already knows to say, I'm sorry, I can't discuss this, you need to go to our PR guy. So it's more about obviously trying to agree a way of handling any crisis without actually knowing what the crisis would be, because I would hope, of course, that if you knew a crisis was coming well in advance, that you would then, you know, take the steps necessary to avoid that happening. And actually, that's another fundamental truth that I've learned. I often tell clients, you know, if you want to avoid headlines and appearing in the media for clubbing baby seals to death, then what you need to do is not come up with a clever press release, is to ring the crew that are on their way with on the Arctic with their clubs ready to, you know, club these seals to death, ring them and call them off. Tell them to turn around and go back to base. The best way to not appear in the paper for clubbing baby seals to death is to not club them to death. And actually, you'd be surprised how even high-ranking executives think, you know, often they see it as a reputation problem rather than it being a them problem. You're having a reputation problem because you're doing the wrong thing here, Mr. Client. Stop doing it. You see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So to me, this is one of those scenarios where common sense sometimes isn't very common, right? So if you know you're doing some bad things, stop doing those bad things. Now, on the other side of that, I think you're right. Look, if you are producing supplements, and you're sending them out to millions of people, chances are, sooner or later, something may go wrong. You know, maybe tampering, maybe spoiled product. You're going to have a recall for some reason. And I think that, you know, you could be proactive and, as you said, set up a system in advance. If something bad happens, who do we call? What are we going to train everybody on? And this comes back down to having a system in place. Everybody's trained on it. And if you're ever approached by the media, you are not allowed to say anything. Have everybody, you know, in the media contact our media relationship person or whatever, and that's it. But all this comes down to training in advance so you can avoid some of this stuff. And, some of the stuff, like you said – you hope it never happens, but look, the reality is if you're an automobile manufacturer, I should say, chances are you having a recall are almost guaranteed. Now, it's not going to happen every year, but at least once in a lifetime, you're going to have a recall on something. And so be prepared for that. But I love the simple, easy strategy: if you're behaving badly, stop it now.
Absolutely. Most of our PR crisis management issues the reputational crisis is a manifestation of a deeper problem. It's not the problem in itself. It is a problem to sort that day, but on the other hand, sometimes even then, you know, it can be a catalyst to actually sorting the problem that's, you know, that has manifested itself in a reputational problem, because the media, rightly, are going to want to know, back to what we said right at the beginning of this interview, is they're going to want to know that you're going to not do this, and therefore you know, trust is low at that point, you've got to articulate what you're going to do about it, because that's then evidence that you've thought about it, reflected on it, and can be held accountable for it. Because, you know, a generic, oh, we're going to try our best to put this right. Well, what specifically are you going to do? That's ultimately what the question that you should be preempting and answering, because then people can hold, you know, call you to account and say, well, you know, this has happened again, and you said a year ago it wouldn't happen again. Why? And the more specific you are, the better. But the more human you are, the better. You know, if anyone is injured or suffers some kind of damage from our clients, the first thing is the chief executive should express genuine sympathy for that person. You know, and often they don't. They get caught up, particularly with lawyers, who say, you know, you can't apologise or express sympathy because that's an admission of guilt. And actually, it's not. You can say, well, look, I don't know the facts from a legal point of view, but I certainly know that we've got a customer here who's unhappy, and I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen again. That's not an admission of guilt, but you've expressed remorse and you've expressed an empathy. Ultimately, that is what you want. And that is a big problem when lawyers draft these kind of things, really, because their view is to just play safe. Their view is, if you don't apologise and you put out a tweet saying the passenger was reaccommodated, that's legally accurate. But as you've seen, when $1 billion is wiped off United Airlines' share price, is that it might be legally accurate, but it doesn't deal with the emotional reality of how people choose to interact with brands and with companies. And that can be just as damaging.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so let's talk about this. Again, the book, Fast PR, you talk about why burying bad news is a fatal mistake. What do you mean?
Because it'll come back to bite you in the bottom, as we would say here in England. You can't bury
but
bad
when you
news.
Say, but when you say yeah. when you say burying bad news, you're talking about what? Are you talking about, again, let's say United Airlines, using them as an example? You know, there's no way that they can bury this. I mean, it's out. It was headline news for almost a week solid, or maybe 2 weeks solid. So, you know, some of these things, there's no way you can bury it. And so when you say don't bury bad news, give me a specific idea of what you're talking about.
So some crises and some bits of bad news are unforeseen and have to happen that day. So, you know, particularly if, like, for example, with United Airlines, when that man was removed from the plane forcibly, no one could have realised that was going to happen. It was video footage that people had taken on their cell phones, and it was given to the networks, and you had to react to it. But there's often bad news that a company has to announce where they do have some control over the timing of it. And that's the bit where companies are led into error and they try to bury it. And they do it by two ways. One is they just try to kick the can down the road and, you know, just hang on to it without actually announcing it. And then ultimately it comes upon them because a deadline will pass, or someone will find out about it, and then they've, you know, just we're back to square one. But the other way traditionally of burying bad news is to deliberately time the release of the bad news on a day when the media are going to be covering something else, like the President's State of the Union address or whatever it might be, where you know there's going to be a busy news day, and you deliberately choose to release it on that day. And that I think that that's bad ethically, and I also think the media are wising up to it now, and consumers and readers and citizens are wising up to this now, and I think it just backfires. It looks deliberately cynical and it looks deliberately manipulative, and my view is that you should just fess up to it and off to it and get on with it and admit it as soon as you possibly can, and to get it out of the way. I mean, some clients of ours will say to us, you know, here's something that I don't really want the media to know about. You know, what should I do about it? And I always say to them, right, let's create a blog post about this immediately. And they'll say, oh, I'm sorry, Paul, I think you must have misheard. I've just said I don't want the media to know about this. Why have you just advised to write a blog post? And I'll say, because no one's reading your blog at the moment, so to do it won't attract attention. But 5 years from now, when the media find out about it, and then they want to run a big story about it, you can say, I'm sorry, guys, I've never tried to hide this at all. In fact, if you look, there's a blog post that's 5 years old where I discuss this in detail. And then they can go to WordPress.com or whatever it is and actually see that the post was genuinely posted there and has been in the public domain for 5 years. At that point, it kills the story. Because what really adds a sense of intrigue to stories like this is when you feel that the person doesn't want to know this, that extra element of intrigue, like, wow, this is something he didn't want us to know. And the way to kill it stone dead is to say, well, I've never been ashamed of this. I've tried to hide it. There it is, me discussing it 5 years ago. That would kill the story stone dead. And ultimately, you know, that works with PR as well, that, you know, if you've got a story that you know that's going to come out, that there will be a reputational challenge for the client, then rather than kind of burying your head in the sand and waiting to be discovered and just making it look worse, because the journalist is, if you're on the back foot, the journalist is going to have to say, news has come to light, blah, blah, blah. Whereas if you go to a friendly journalist and say, look, you know, mea culpa, we've got this wrong, you know, do you want to cover this? Then inevitably, because you brought it to them, it's human nature that they're going to give you more time in the article to explain your side of the story. So, you know, burying your head in the sand is not an option.
Yeah, and this kind of reminds me of what is a very much a human thing, and that is if you're transparent with people, they tend not to care as much, right? And of course, like you said, if you try to hide it, it just unfortunately brings curiosity, and that curiosity can sometimes snowball. And but you're right. I mean, look, what's interesting is that, again, it's this human nature that we don't want to talk about our mistakes. We don't want to. I don't want to necessarily tell you my mistakes or how vulnerable I have been and stuff like that. But at the same time, if you've ever watched somebody tell their story about their big mistake, you know, about how they did something terrible in their marriage, how they, you know, whatever, how they were addicted to drugs, how they, you know, whatever that human frailty is, when somebody is transparent about it, we almost have empathy for them. We can like, yeah, I get that. It can happen to anybody. And you don't make a big deal out of it. But when people try to hide it, especially people with these big companies, and like you said, they get the lawyers involved and all this other stuff, it just makes it bigger than it is.
It's the cover-up that always kills people and not the crime itself. I always do think that if Richard Nixon, for example, in Watergate, if he just released all of the tapes all at once, unedited, it would have been a huge furore for about a week, and then it would have died down. But actually, because they were released ad hoc, clearly there was lots of edits and all of these kind of things, and that added an element of intrigue. Or what did he say? What about this? What about that? And also the drip, drip, drip effect. You know, what would have been a horrendous story for about a week was actually needlessly dragged out for months, and that allowed a huge amount of momentum to be built up. I mean, I'm certainly not defending, you know, what he did. But on the other hand, I can see as a PR person that, you know, that you don't bury bad news. You just get it out. You do a mea culpa. You mean it. You mean the fact that you're sorry and the apology. And then you get on with it because most people will forgive.
Absolutely. You know what? Okay, so let's look at another presidential mistake, and that is Bill Clinton. You know, when Bill Clinton was caught with who was it? Was it Miss Flowers? Anyway, there were so many. Yeah, there were so many women involved. Bottom line is, he just basically said, "I did not have sexual relationships with that woman," and the media knew he was lying. The world knew this man was lying, and we were after him, and they would not leave it alone. But once he owned up to it and said, "I'm wrong. I did, in fact, have sexual relationships with that woman," it was like done. And, you know, something that was talked about every day for 2 weeks was finally over with, and people had moved on.
it's always the best way is to just cough to it, and then it takes the tension out of the situation. And I've often found that it's, you know, the best way to take a situation is to just agree with the person immediately and mean it, because it's actually the disagreement is perpetuated by the fact that you disagree with them. But actually, if you're being defensive, I often say to clients, don't be, admit to it, and then it'll be a 10-second conversation. So many political discussions are, you know, on the television are between the news anchor and the journalist and a politician, and the viewer knows that the politician, the news anchor, is trying their best to get the answer out of the politician, and the politician can't admit that there was this problem. If the politician just turned around right at the outset of the interview and said, yep, we've made a mistake there, we're going to put it right, then actually the rest of the interview would be, you know, the airtime will be used according to what the politician wanted, because actually the anchor wouldn't have prepared for that and said, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? Well, that's a great question as well, Mr. Journalist, because I'm going to do X, Y, and Z about this. And I'd like to also use this time to talk about blah, blah, blah. It's amazing, isn't it, just how even people operating at the highest level of business and politics don't get very basic issue, you know, basic motivations, human motivations, aside, because they get locked into this gladiatorial style combat of news anchor versus top CEO or top politician, where, you know, it's all sound and fury and it signifies nothing. No viewer or listener comes out of watching something like that feeling they've got the truth. It's just the journalist and the politician trying to one-up on each other and beat them at the game. But the truth is the ultimate, suffers the most, in my view.
Right. Absolutely. And something that you kind of hinted to, and I want to talk about this, do you think that you can leverage an industry-wide crisis into an opportunity?
Yes. I mean, clearly if a journalist is asking, you know, if the media are interested in what you're doing, whether it be you personally or you as a member of the industry, then my view is it doesn't matter whether it's kind of hostile or whether it's inquiring or whatever the tone is, it's your opportunity to shape that attention and take advantage, because the biggest problem, the biggest challenge in PR is getting the attention of journalists. So I always say to clients, you know, if you think it's hostile, don't see it as an opportunity. Always see it as an opportunity, because the alternative is that the media aren't interested in you, and that to me is actually a fate worse than death when it comes to PR. If whatever reason they've got you on air, you're then on air. So say your bit, you know, apologize, and then use it as an opportunity to communicate what you want to get across.
Absolutely. Yes, I love that. Absolutely. Hey, Paul, we're out of time. It's been delightful having you on the show today, talking about fast PR, and the book is available at Amazon. Amazon and wherever good books are sold. Again, it's called Fast PR. Give yourself a media boost. The best-selling author is Paul Blanchard. Paul Blanchard, thank you so much for stopping by.
Oh, it's been a huge honor and a privilege, and I've hugely enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for your time. The questions were absolutely great.
Thank you so much. Good stuff there from Paul Blanchard. You know, and it's so true about just, you know, being transparent, being sincere, right, and not hiding behind a bunch of legal mumbo-jumbo. Not that that's not important sometimes. If you're involved in a situation where we're talking legal stuff, then we need, you know, you need to figure out a way so that you can come across sincere without admitting anything. That's all I'm talking about. Good stuff there. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.